Hey team, before we get underway, just to let you know, this chat with Tara went pretty long. So we've divided in two, one divided by two. So that's two halves. So this is part one of the chat with Tara Jarrett. Really interesting. I really enjoyed it. I think you will too. G'day team. Welcome to another installment of The U Project. Hi, Melissa.
Hello. Happy Saturday.
Happy Saturday to you. You live in a zoo. You look. No, I won't say that. That's what we used to sing when we were kids back in the day when you could sing silly ditties without being, I don't know, sued or something. How's your Saturday going?
Oh, even better now, but it's going very well. Thank you.
Rock solid. It's 102 p.m. here in the Bayside, thriving metropolis, that is Hampton. How's Blackburn Central or wherever you live?
Yeah, very good.
I always forget where you live, which is very bad because we've been business partners or colleagues or whatever for a decade. I should probably know.
Well, look, I'm proud. I'm proud that you've worked that out and it is great here. Thank you.
It only took me about a decade to remember your birthday and I could still have it wrong. And the only reason I know it's your birthday is it's within a week or so of mine. And also somebody I've been very tight with and close friends with for 30 years who we're about to talk to, it was her birthday yesterday and I rang up and I went, I won't say exactly what I went said because I don't say things like that publicly, but it had the... I can't say it. I really want to say it because I know 90% of our listeners would just fucking laugh and about 3% would send me emails and I can't be fucked responding. But I did ring up and say, g'day, you old so-and-so. And she went, oh, thanks, honey. And then I went, what? That seems like it. And then all of a sudden I realised I was ringing her to do a podcast and it happened to be her birthday lunch that she was out at. So Tara Jarrett, happy birthday for yesterday.
Thank you so much. Thank you for ringing me.
Do you know what I did badly? Because as I thought about 17 seconds later, fuck, I should have just rolled with it and pretended that that's why I was ringing, but I wasn't quick enough on my feet.
No,
I had to own up and go, I had no idea. I'm a fuckwit. I just happened to be ringing. And by the way, everyone, to my friends and the people that I care about in general, do not expect a birthday call from me unless I see your name on Facebook because I'm shit with birthdays, which is quite ironic because I have a brain that remembers all kinds of shit I don't need to remember, like factoids from 100 years ago. But anyway, how was your birthday?
My birthday was great because we got out of lockdown, unlike you poor people in Melbourne. So I actually went out for lunch and then I went out for dinner. I sat in the sunshine with family and friends. So it was actually really lovely to actually get out of the house. Yeah, I will say, unless you told me it was Saturday today, I reckon I would have just gone, wait, what? What date is it? Because it's just been a blur.
Well, all the days are the same. For some people, I mean, it depends on where you are, but for me, it's like Wednesday is Sunday is Tuesday is. It makes no difference to how much I work or how much I study or how much I watch Netflix or how much I walk to the beach or how many. We were saying before, you were referring to my lack of geographical adventure, suggesting that I am something of a homebody. And when I said I literally can't, I'm not even being funny when I can't remember where Melissa lives. I know what direction, but I often can't remember the suburb because I don't go there. But you were suggesting quite rudely but somewhat accurately that I could have a 1K radius and I'd probably be fine.
Exactly. You've been in lockdown now for, I don't know, 20 years.
30 years.
That is so true.
I've been in lockdown since I bought this house, which was 1995, and living like a fucking hermit, you know. But I don't know. It is interesting, isn't it? But anyway, it is what it is. And let's not talk about fucking COVID or the pandemic anymore, except to say, were you now... For those who missed the first chat with Tara, let me give you the 30-second snapshot. Tara and I have been friends for years. We work together. Her husband and I work together. They both worked initially in my gyms for me and then in another gym that we set up together as business partners. And then I also worked for Tara in an organization called High Energy Network, which ran fitness industry courses. She was a pioneer in the fitness space. And so her husband and I and Tara, and I'm one of her three boys' godfather, which is a fucking interesting decision in hindsight. What were you thinking? Limited options. It's all I can come up with. But we've been tight for a long time, and it's so you still have a gym, of course. Now you have gym up there in the thriving metropolis of Kyabram, but it's not open at the moment, is it?
No. And it's been closed, as you know, as all other gyms for in excess of 200 plus days now in the last sort of 12 months. So it is devastating. It's devastating what's happened to that industry. So I'm hoping, Russ is hoping next week that he gets a chance to open the doors and we can do some limited outdoor training. That's it. But on the scale of things, it's a very poor band-aid for our members.
And to give some people some more context, so you did basically what we used to call in the old days a phys ed degree with a dip teaching at the end, was it? Diploma of teaching, or was it all integrated?
Mine was integrated. So I was at Rusden, which is Deakin University. So mine was a four-year degree.
Right.
I majored in ex-phys and human movement, but I did a teaching degree as well with chem biology. So had a science background as well.
So we're going to talk about
a long time ago.
Well, that was. Well, you are old, as evidenced by yesterday's 52nd birthday. 52nd birthday. You do look good, though. You don't look a day over 51. Now,
awesome. Over 51.
We're going to talk about business and stuff, but I want to talk about the fundamentals of coming up with an idea and then turning it into a thing. But before we do that, we were chatting off air. I want to chat about this because it's get to know your guest time with Craig. You are literally sitting in, Melissa brought it to our attention. Melissa, tell our audience, what was the question you asked Tara? Did you ask it?
Yeah, well, to give you some context, Tara is sitting in front of this magnificent bookshelves.
That description seems inadequate, doesn't it?
Just like a whole wall worth of shelves. And they are beautifully styled. And what I really love about it is that they're all color coordinated. So they're all these beautiful books and all in sections based on their color. And I wanted to know whether they were just there for styling purposes or whether Tara had actually read them. And Tara, what was the answer?
The answer was I have read them, and I can't buy the amount of books I read anymore. I have to do audio books or download them on Kindle because I'm running out of rooms to put them in. It's a wall of books, but I've also got them shoved in drawers and cupboards, and they're everywhere.
It is like I said, it is hard to do what I can see and Melissa can see justice. It is literally, think about a large, large, say, living room.
I'll send you a photo.
And a whole wall of that living room. I'm not talking about 10 feet. I'm talking 30, 40, 50 feet probably 30 feet, 40 feet, is just floor-to-ceiling shelves jammed with what looks like thousands of books. It's probably 1,000-ish.
There's just over 1,000.
Right. This one. And plus the ones in the drawers. You know who else has got, you know who else is a little bit like you, but worse is Paul Check.
Oh, really?
Yeah, Paul Check has allegedly got over 10,000 books in his personal library, like hardcover books that he's read. That wouldn't surprise me. That was one of the most interesting podcasts I've had. Melissa, can you look up that number while we're chatting?
Sure.
You're like young Jamie. If I'm Joe Rogan, you're young Jamie. Now people who know Joe Rogan will know what that means. But he, you would have, obviously you know who Paul Check is, but have you ever spoken with him, Tara?
A long time ago. I think with you, actually.
Right.
A long time ago.
Well, I had a couple of encounters with him. So I did some presenting with him in Colorado where we sat, we presented at the same program or the same conference, and then we sat next to each other eating dinner. Then we sat next to each other. We stayed at a place called Breckenridge, which is, like I said, in Colorado. It's up in the snow. And getting a mini bus from where we were staying to the venue and all. And so sitting with him and talking, and I've spoken to some smart people, it's like, I'm too dumb for this conversation. And I felt like that
education on the way there.
Oh, dude, and I think back then I was dumber. I think I'm slightly smarter now. And I said this when we interviewed, remember Melissa, or maybe it was with Tiff. Yeah, it was with Tiff, where I interviewed a guy who's a professor of theoretical quantum physics, Professor Amit Goswami, right? Well, his IQ's 9,000 and I'm a wombat with curly gray hair, and I was just barely, like, do you know when you, it's not only do you not know what's going on, you don't even know what's a question to ask.
You were hanging on by a thin thread.
Yeah, yeah. So here's my next question. McDonald's or Hungry Jack's? What? Yeah, so.
That poll check episode, by the way, was 142.
If you want to listen to something that's either going to blow your mind or confuse the shit out of you, listen to that episode. Thanks, Melissa. So of the 1,000-plus books that you've got on your shelves.
How did you get to here? But anyway, yes, which ones are my favourites?
Well, I mean, not favourite, but surely there are books that have had a more significant imprint on your, look at you looking around. It's hilarious. She's now turning around looking at the 1,000 books like something's going to pop out.
Oh, there's such a variety on there. I'm everything from I love a good crime thriller novel to I'm quite creative and a little bit arty in my own sort of strange way. So I've actually got a lot of my dad's original books that he had when he did a fine arts degree. I kept all of those, and I've actually got his original, all his assignments and everything that I've bound and kept all those, but even heaps of anatomy, physiology, you know, exercise science-based books because that's my passion, as well as, everything else.
Not one book that you go, fuck, I love this book more than...
I could probably give you 10, but I've got specific authors I really love.
Like?
I love an epic, like a good Wilbur Smith novel, and if I'm going fiction, I'd have a Matthew Riley, who's an amazing Australian author, who's just brilliant, so...
I reckon you and I are a little bit similar, right? Because we both come from a kind of a science background. We both did similar degrees, and I'm doing another science degree now. But I am not naturally uber scientific. I'm uber curious, which ties into science. Like, I'm very curious. So yes. I'm curious, but I'm more creative than I am straight scientist. Like, for me to be a scientist is work and discipline, although I love the scientific. No, that's not true. I don't. No, I love
you
bits
like
the of
knowledge.
It. I love the idea of science. I love the knowledge. The scientific process at the highest level can be somewhat laborious, but that's okay. It's necessary. I love the problem solving and the creativity that intersects with science, but also I had a screen printing business. I've written lots of books.
Yeah.
I've been creating ideas for workshops and programs and businesses my whole life, which is people think it's a business process. It's actually a creative process with a business outcome, right?
But so that's why you are where you are. To actually be entrepreneurial, you've got to have a creative element. So yes, yours and my entrepreneurial element at times involves science, but you without that creative aspect, I don't think you could have that sort of same business acumen if you didn't have that sort of creative bravery is probably term too.
And I think also the other thing that you and I had in common was, I don't know whether or not you thought this clearly and had a light bulb, but I think it's as evidenced by the path you took, it was true, is that we both went, nah, I don't really want a job. I want to work for myself. Oh. I want to work. I just don't want a 9 to 5. I don't want to clock in and clock off. Nothing wrong with that, but yep. not for me.
Yep. My only job I ever had was I was employed as a teacher for 18 months at Glen Waverley Secondary College back when I was 22.
Mm.
And since then I've been unemployed.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, and I say that I couldn't work for anyone because I just want to change too much. I think I'd be a nightmare to employ.
Oh, fuck. Could you imagine trying to employ me? I would literally get fired on the first day. I would be the worst employee in Australia.
I know. So there has to be a place for us.
I know. That's fucking misfits, weirdos, nonconformists, exactly. and misfits. But look, exactly. it is really an interesting conversation because nearly everyone who's listening to this has a job, will have a job, mm-hmm. or has had a job, right? And just the idea around, you know, how we work, the conditions under which we work, the paradigm that we create or step into, because there are a couple of like clear options. One is you go and step into someone else's operating system and you become part of that. All right, yep. I'm working for Australia Post. This is the job. This is the role. These are the responsibilities, terms and conditions, pay, work care, whatever it is. Fucking, what is it called, Melissa? Work care? I don't know.
Work cover?
Work cover, thank you, sick pay, holiday, all the stuff that comes with, see, I've never had a job, I don't know. But all of that stuff, or I'm going to create my own operating system, right? And exactly. It's not good or bad, it's not better or worse. Tell us about, now, how old were you when you created High Energy Network?
I was 21.
Tell people what High Energy Network was.
High Energy Network, it's now an organisation called AFA, Australian Fitness Academy. So people might have heard of the Australian Fitness Academy. Well, there's a lot of High Energy Network students out there too because we had thousands of them. We ran the fitness instructor training courses, certificate 3 and 4 courses also, and arms of that, so group exercise and nutrition courses and all of those affiliated courses that you could do within an RTO. And so started that in 1992, and that's when I met you. And then, yeah, it just evolved from there, and it's still going. And it's still in its original location. It was in Caulfield, in Glen Huntley Road.
701 Glen Huntley Road. That's it.
701. I was trying to think of the number the other day.
701, dude. 701. I can tell you all the addresses everywhere I've ever been. All of my businesses, all of my houses.
You don't know my birthday.
Yeah, not important. But look, happy birthday for yesterday.
Yeah, just again.
So there's not many 21-year-old girls or guys, for that matter, women or men, who there are a percentage of course, but who, well, especially back then. Mm.
Yeah.
I mean, you're talking 30-ish years, no, 80, no, 92. You're talking nearly 30 years ago, 3 decades ago. It was much, much more traditional and typical. We would either leave school and get a job, work in retail, get a trade, go to university if you're super smart like Tara, get a 4-year degree and then go into that profession and then work in that profession generally for another organisation. But there were very few. I mean, you were literally an entrepreneur at 21. You were creating, you were building, you were registering a business, you were renting space, you were designing courses, you were coming up with ideas to get bums on seats, for want of a better term. Was that innate?
It just didn't seem weird. Yeah, it just was innate. It just didn't seem weird to me. It just felt normal. So I was teaching and wanted to do, I think I've got this, I can't sit still, and I couldn't sit still back then. And with teaching, I found that I was finishing work at 3:30, 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And then it's like, well, what else do you do with the rest of your day? So I was instructing in gyms and then couldn't find instructors that could fulfill the roles adequately that we wanted to do. As group exercise was a big thing back there, so I just started training people how I wanted them to instruct. And then it evolved from there, basically, and it became so successful that I gave up teaching to the horror of my parents because I was giving up a real job to go do something very risky that they couldn't understand at that point for, I guess, a young girl to do. And then it just kept going. So it just evolved.
My parents were thrilled when I said, I'm setting up a personal training center. And they said,
yeah, I can imagine.
I said, what now? What? I go, personal training center. They're like, no, you're not. I'm like, no, I sure am. They're like, what is it? Then I described it and they went, hey, not a thing though, is it? I went, well, it's not yet, but it will be. You know, it's stand by, there'll be one. Mm-hmm. And they love me, but they didn't, you know, they really didn't try to dissuade me, but it's not like they were jumping around the kitchen, pumping their fist in the air when I told them my plans, because it didn't, you know, understandably, because they grew up. I mean, they were born in 1939. Mm-hmm. Like, you literally go to school till you're 15 if you're doing well, and then you get a job and you stay in a version of that job for 50 years and then retire. That was kind of the paradigm when they grew up. So me going, I'm creating a new industry, like, fucking no, you're not.
But I think your parents, like mine, gave up at, you know, within a couple of years, they're just like, it didn't matter what I told them I was going to do. They were just like, of course she is.
Yeah, like, yeah.
Of course you are.
I think one of the things about, like, is recognizing, like, if you're going to, like, when I talk to people about doing something, stepping out of something and into something else, whether or not they're stepping into something that's already happening, like there's already an industry, already a service, that's cool. But you know, we need a point of difference or a unique selling proposition or whatever you want to call it, so that it's like if somebody comes to me and goes, like, which is, how do I don't want to be inappropriate, but like literally, I haven't even told you this, Melissa, but 80 meters from my house on the other side of the road, guess what opened up about 4 months ago? Oh, a new personal training center. So that's 37 in Hampton Street. And I just felt like, and they might go great. Let's hope they go great. But on Hampton Street, within 1 kilometer of my house, either way, there would be 20 fitness businesses, be it be it Pilates, be it exercise physiology, be it gyms like Recreationers down the road, PT studios, bar. There's just a plethora of fitness, and that's not including all the physios and OTs and chiros and massage joints. And
the massive amount of white noise in terms of fitness white noise, I call it, and you've got to find your way through that white noise. What's going to cut through that makes people look at me, other than, as you said, the other 30, 40, 50 surrounding. And I'm finding that at the moment, I've now got a business that I deliberately opened up in amongst other similar businesses, because I knew I had that unique selling point. I knew I'd have something different that they couldn't offer, but I could actually bounce off them at the same time. And I'm finding now that they're trying to almost compete with me on price and the wrong things, because the things that they're trying to compete with aren't the things that people have actually started to come to us for. So it's really interesting that you say that, in terms of just the amount of competitors out there that are just doing the same thing. It's like, stop doing the same thing. Figure out what people want and figure out how to stand out.
And beautiful. And so we're always trying to, in business, we're always trying to do something slightly different or better. We're trying to solve a problem. We're trying to fill a hole in the market. We're trying to meet.
We're trying to meet a need.
What?
Yeah. See, you get that. Exactly what you said then is exactly what you should be doing. But I think there's too many people that go, oh, I'm going to open up a PT studio, and they do it exactly the same as PT studio A, B, and C down the road, because that's the way you do it. And that's what they look like, and they all look the same, and they all do the same thing, and they all charge the same. And it's just cloning what what already exists.
I think it depends on, I agree, and let's not be too, I agree with you. One, you're right, but also I would, if somebody did that, I would say, look, what's your goal? Is your goal to stand out? Is your goal to excel? Is your goal to be profitable and successful above your competitors? Then if that's the case, you're doing the wrong thing because you're literally just replicating what they're doing.
Exactly.
If your goal is to have your own space where you don't have a boss and you can make X amount of dollars a week and kind of just chip away for the next 1 to 5 years, you just want, it's about the lifestyle and the situation, then perfect, because you don't need a million clients. But if you want to create something that potentially will grow and evolve and expand and proliferate and turn into a bigger business rather than you just having a space where you do PT or where you do Pilates or where you do coffee and sandwiches or where you do whatever the product or service. So it depends on the reason that you're going into business. It's like one of my clients back in the day was a lawyer. I'm scrambling for his name. But he was a lawyer. He fucking hated it.
Yeah.
And what he did was, this is hilarious, not hilarious, this is, I love this story. He created his own landscaping and gardening business because he was, that was what he was into. He tolerated law but celebrated gardening, right? Mm-hmm. And he ended up becoming, like, he didn't have anyone who worked for him. He ended up doing probably making as much or more dough, and he just loved it. He had no employees, maybe one down the track, did his own thing. A lot of people would go, wow, that's a rapid descent from lawyer to gardener. For him, it was a drastic improvement. And so, like, I think when we're thinking about building a model for work, like not just building a business necessarily, but building a career that works for us, right? So there's the, and we're going to talk about your business because it's clever. And by the way, folks, we're not here to sell Tara's business. We're just talking about how to evolve. Like, I think, like, I literally a few years ago, somebody that I was coaching and mentoring offered me 20% of their gym, like to give it to me. 20% equity, zero. We just want you to be there semi-regularly and be involved. And I'm like, no, thank you. I am definitely not interested. It's not bad. It's just not me. That I do not want to be in a gym. I love gyms. I don't want to own one. I don't want to run one. I've done it. They're great, but I'm in a different space now. Not bad, not terrible, just not for me right now. And so I think that this, I'll shut up in a minute. I think that this building of a career or a business, it's got to work on a commercial level and have potential for growth and expansion if that's what you want. But also it needs to be something that you fucking love and that excites you and meets your emotional, yes, it needs to meet your financial needs, but if you're meeting your financial needs but you fucking hate it, guess what? Yeah. It's a shit business.
You've got to have some authenticity with it. You have to, or exactly, it's not going to, unless you really believe in it, I think truly believe in it, it's not going to be as successful as you really want it to be. And you are going to find it just becoming a job. You won't last long term in it. And there has to be that element of love and want to be there.
And you think about how many of our, as adults, between 18 and say whatever, fill in the blank, 65, you think of how many of our, not just how many of our hours that we work, right? But our prime hours, like prime hours, like the day, morning to
doing something I hated. Exactly.
Oh my God. Yes. You know, I think the sad thing for me is, and I mean this with respect, not judgment, is people that I know could do awesome shit, but they stay in a job or a business or an operating system that really doesn't make them happy, joyful, fulfilled. They don't learn, they don't grow, but they're too scared to get out of it. And then boom, they're 40. Right. And then, you know, it's just so but the thing is that we don't, and not that we necessarily, who's going to teach it, but we don't get taught this stuff. We don't get taught, you know, like, You don't learn that in business 101.
No, we got three boys, and Mitchell's was nearly 22, and the other two are nearly 16. But the thing we keep pushing constantly is you have to find what you love. Don't go to university doing what you think you should do. What do you want to do? You know, you don't have to make your mind up right now in terms of your lifetime career, but you've got to find what you love and what your passion is and work around that. Mm. You'll always find something around something that you do love. And no one told me that.
Mm.
You know, when I was young, you're either a teacher, a nurse, a doctor, a lawyer, or a tradie or a hairdresser. You know, there was clear pigeonholes on what your career was going to be.
Mm.
You know, there was no box for entrepreneurs coming up with ideas and designing some sort of niche that wasn't there before. That was just crazy stuff. So now I think there is more room for that. Mm. But I think there's so many people, like you said, that are stuck in careers that they just hate but don't know how to get out of.
Well, one of the reasons for that, I think, tell me what you think, both you, Melissa, jump in at any time, because you've been as integral to developing this podcast and the You Project, our business, as I have, is that we are innately risk averse. You know, we want the outcome without the work or the risk or the potential danger or the uncertainty or the the pain.
Want a guarantee. Well, guarantee me it's going to work.
Yeah, like, yeah, yeah. And it's like, I'm in this job that's a 3 out of 10, but I know exactly what I'm getting. I'm earning 70 grand a year, got 4 weeks holiday a year, got sick pay, got this, got that, pretty good conditions. I don't really like it, and I can't fucking wait for Friday. Monday, I feel a bit sick in the guts Monday morning because I've got another week of it. I guess if people resign themselves to that and they, for the most part, are okay with that, well, that's fine. But it's, you know, again, just my opinion, I wouldn't do it. You don't need to have a shit existence. You don't need to do 3 out of 10. And by the way, you're not going to jump out of that into something awesome in 5 minutes. And there might be a month or six months or 2 or 5 years of pain and grinding. But, you know, as you learn and develop and explore what you love and are passionate about rather than the job you think you should have.
But I think that's easier for people like, say, you and I, because we were surrounded by you and I. Does that make sense? We always say you're the product of the five people you spend the most time with. Well, when we were in our prime and our developmental ages for, you know, developing our careers, we were surrounded by each other and we were all like-minded and thought outside the box. But if you're surrounded by, people that's the norm, you know, you don't think like that, or I don't know how to actually go about achieving something different than what I'm doing now, I think it becomes really hard. So it is tricky to try and escape that bubble sometimes.
And I think you're exactly right. You know, hang out with people who drag you up or at the very least encourage or support you, but also challenge you. We don't need a fan club.
But no.
Like, I think the great thing is, you know, like when I set up Hampton, Hampton Street. Then I set up Hampton, my second gym, Bluff Road. Then we set up Caulfield, and then I set up Nepean Highway, like all different. And there was no, after the first one, there was no one at any stage going, what are you doing? Like, don't you? Mm. Like, because all of a sudden it's like, oh, okay, this is a thing and it works.
It works.
And you've got a track. It's like, you know what else? I mean, there are many things, but like when you write a book, when you write your first book, people are like, what are you doing though? I go, I'm writing a book. They're like, hey, you're not an author though. You're Harps. Come on, don't be stupid. And it's not directly that, but that's the vibe, right? And then you write a book and it goes okay and it sells and you sell quite a few, and then that gets picked up by Jeff Slattery Publishing and that gets turned into a bigger, better version of the original book. Now you're working with an organization that publishes books and works with publishers and editors and has branding and marketing, distribution and international recognition, and all of a sudden, oh, he's an author.
Author.
I'm the exact same dude It's just that now you know that I've done some, I'm the exact same fucking human with the same talent that you didn't recognize, but I've just done some things now. I'm no smarter. I've got a few more skills, but that potential was always there. And then by the time you've written a bunch like I have, you know, that's something I get introduced as, and amongst other things, you know, an author. And I, by the way, don't think I'm a brilliant author, but you know, you can't get good at the thing that you won't do.
Exactly. Exactly.
Like you can't get good at business by thinking about business but avoiding it.
Oh, but there's plenty of experts out there that'll tell you that you're doing the wrong thing or you're not doing it right but have never actually owned a business. I always find that interesting too. But you are absolutely correct. You've got to, you've just got to do. You've just got to do. Like, and you're not going to be successful every time. You know, we've made mistakes, but I actually think after 30 years, it's all those mistakes that actually make it easier at this point of my life. It's all of that stuff that we did wrong and did right and watching other people and I reckon just observing people. That's where you actually get the most information about, okay, this is how to do it. I know how to do it now.
And you're right. And also being okay with, I mean, you and I have fucked up lots. You and I have done lots of shit, big and small, that didn't work. Right? No, really. Like I've done gigs that were horrendous. I've had businesses that didn't work. I've had business partners that I had fallouts with and I have no issues with any of them now. Nothing terrible, but they're all great people. But, you know, you're human. I've had numerous conversations with staff where fucking hell, it was messy, but I was the problem half the, like, it's just like growth is messy and painful and problematic and beautiful and awesome and terrifying and fun. Like that's growth, and that's growth in business. That's growth in relationships. That's growth in intellect. Like it's a fucking messy journey. If all you're about is stagnation, then change nothing.
You also have to be willing to grow. There's a lot of people out there that don't want to be told that, that they're the problem sometimes, or to actually look back and reflect and learn. You've got to learn from your mistakes. You have to be open to looking back and go, oh, that was shitty. I fucked up there.
Shouldn't have
done it that way.
Do you know what I love about our listeners, and I mean this genuinely, is we have very little blowback, do we, Melissa?
Yeah, exactly.
And I'm pretty hard. Like I go hard in the paint and there's a shock. But the reason that I go hard is not because I want to offend anyone, contraire. I want to encourage people to explore their ability because I know this, when I'm being precious and self-protective and defensive, which I can be, I'm putting myself in a prison, an emotional, psychological, behavioral prison. Like I can't grow and learn and get good if my priority is to be right, if my priority is to be comfortable, if my priority is to be certain, if my priority is to win the argument, then I'm not growing, right? But
what? I reckon that's rare.
But isn't it great when people can go, and it's, again, as I always say, not self-loathing, fuck self-loathing, that's bullshit, self-awareness where you go, I'm the problem. And I think for me, I reckon you'll argue, but I reckon you're more talented and gifted than I've ever been, and I've known you for a long time, right? But what I love about being innately mediocre is that it made me pretty hungry.
Yes, agree. Yes.
Made me pretty driven.
Yeah, I'm the same. This is weird because I was actually having this conversation within myself a couple of days ago thinking what made me so driven, you know, what drives me, what's different. And it's been there from a really young age. And I think it comes from, not wanting to, growing up in a family where my parents were farmers and always, you know, struggled. I didn't want to do that. I always knew I wanted to try and achieve more, get more is the wrong answer, but achieve more and create more. And it still drives me. It still drives me now. And I want my kids to have that as well. Mm. But yeah, it, being driven is the exact term I was searching for.
Did you have a moment in time where you felt, or where you had a moment, a light bulb, an experience that made you more fucking determined? Or, because I had one and I'll share after you, but like something, was there a trigger? Was there an event? Was there a person that made you, or was a catalyst for you to really step into? Because I remember the 22-year-old you, and you were fucking fierce. And you were making decisions, you were creating businesses, you were employing people that were 20 years older than you, you were doing all this awesome shit. And I used to look at you and go, how does this, I was going to say chick, you can't say that now, I don't give a fuck, sue me. How does this chick know how to do all this stuff? Like, she's 10, right? But you were just, and you weren't up yourself, because I remember when we met, you came and asked me, and I had no degree and you had a 4-year degree, so I thought you were a genius. And I was just pretending, right? And you were asking me all about PT, which I was kind of pioneering at that stage. But long-winded question. So was there a catalyst for you?
Back then? Back then is probably what I was saying before. I just knew that I wanted to create something bigger.
Mm.
And the only way to do that, I felt as though I was faking it till I made it. So I knew what I wanted to achieve, but I, like you said, I was making this up as I went along. So for me, the best way to achieve it was to find people who were really good at it.
Mm.
So I couldn't do what you did, and I didn't give a crap that you didn't have a degree. I didn't care. And I found other trainers and other people that were really successful in this industry that could teach students. I was good at getting students, and I was good at teaching, you know, a lot of the theoretical stuff. At that stage, I didn't have a lot of practical experience. I was only 22 working in gyms, but I was really good at I was a good teacher. I've always been a good teacher. And so I was good at teaching the background stuff. So I was good at the anatomy and the physiology and the kinesiology and the biomechanics and that side of it.
Mm.
But the practical stuff, I relied on other people. So I wasn't going to try and pretend I was good at it. So I wanted to create a team that I thought was a good team, and that's I guess where that drive, and I wanted to create courses that were better than anyone else's and create students that were better than anyone else's. And I didn't think it was special or different. It was just something I needed to do to actually make my work that I was doing at that point easier. It was just logical to me. If you wanted to find good people, we'll train them, make them good.
And I think we were talking before about, you know, basically just replicating a business that's already there. Yeah. That's another USP is, well, let's do exactly what the others are doing, but much better.
Yeah.
Like, let's create the best course. Let's get the best lecturers and harps. Let's have the best environments. And let's produce the best product so that they come out and they have the best education to step into that space.
Yeah. I think the other one too is where the other, you know, you said, was there a point or was there a specific moment in time? For me, the most obvious one is about 18 months ago. And I didn't want it to happen at 50. I really didn't want to start something new at my age, but I was forced to. And by looking back, I actually started to look at what do people want? I started observing people and actually going, why is this, you know, this industry at the moment's not working? It's not working. Why is it not working? And so for me, a lot of it is what's happening at the moment was a driving factor. COVID and watching people fall apart, watching people searching for something to actually that is different. That doesn't exist, that they needed, that they could access during this crappy time. So that was a driving force too.
Mm.
And that's probably one of the our last 18 months has been a really specific driver for me. because it just sitting back and watching people in this time's just been horrible. Especially women. I'm picking on us girls, but watching women through this time has been an interesting process, and listening to them and finding out what they want. And that's what I started doing about 18 months ago, going, what do you need? What do you want? What's wrong? What's going to help you right now? Yeah.
All right. I'm going to come back in a minute to that, because I want to talk about how you developed what you're doing. But so when we come back to that question of like, what was the thing, I just want to talk for a minute about self-awareness in a good way, self-belief, because I think self-belief is huge, right?
Yeah.
I think most people lack the self-belief to do lots of stuff, like the self-belief to turn up to work and whatever. Yep, got it. But the self-belief to go and start something new, or to whatever it is, go and do a degree, or go and whatever it is, just something new, right? But I remember, like, what was life-changing for me was, and this seems like, and it's got nothing to do with business, but it's got everything to do with the way that I thought, the way that I saw the world, the way that I saw myself in the world, my potential, my possibilities, my potential to be able to have an idea, do something drastic and change my own reality. And that was when I was the fat kid who got in shape in a very short amount of time. And I literally lost 30 kilos in 15 weeks. And I'd been fat my whole life. I'd never been in shape. And I was 14 and I was 92 kilos. And I got down to about 60 in about 15 weeks. And it wasn't that I had better genetics, or I had more hours in a day, or I had more knowledge, or it was just that there was this internal switch, right? And I use this story a lot with people, not because it's about me or weight loss. It's about what we can do when we are genuinely, genuinely, genuinely just compelled to do what's required, right?
Driven. Mm.
So the thing was, I my whole life leading up to that point, I didn't want to be fat. I just was. And if it was my own fault, of course, there was a bit of genetic involvement, but there was also a fair bit of cake, let's just say that, and a fair bit of sitting around, a fair bit of harps. I feel like it was mainly me. I put up my hand, right? But at the same time, I fucking hated me. I hated me. I hated how I looked and felt. I hated being socially clunky. I hated being the last one picked for teams. I hated all that shit. And it was part of my reality. There's no pity party. Just the reality of my story and situation. But when I started to walk and then jog and then jog and then walk and then jog and jog and then jog and run and then run and jog and then fucking run, and the weight fell off, and push-ups and sit-ups and chin-ups and squats and body weight, and then, you know, and I lost a lot of weight. And then a year later, where I'd kind of consolidated everything, now as a fucking athlete, I was a weapon. I went from this fat kid running last in everything, if he could run, to this kid who was not because I was gifted, but just because I pretty much trained harder than everyone.
Yeah.
And I was, all of a sudden, not only was I physiologically different, but I was psychologically, emotionally, and sociologically different. My world was different now. More accurately, my experience of the world was different because I was different. And then what this door opened in my brain that went, what else could you do then? Like, because I never thought I could look or feel or function like I did. That wasn't on the possibility shelf in my brain. I was just a fatty, and hopefully I could lose a few pounds, but definitely never be an athlete, definitely never play footy at any level, definitely, like, so many things that you become convinced this is who I am as a byproduct of all that shit. But for me, that was the moment in my life that opened the door on dreaming and being curious and being willing to try things that I thought that innately the fear-based me thought, I'm probably not good enough, but I'll have a go anyway.
I also think back, I was terrified the whole time. You know, I don't think that fear basis ever disappears. I remember as I was doing what I've been doing over the years, there was always that element of fear in terms of, oh man, you know, do I know what I'm doing? Can I do this? you know, are people going to think I'm a fraud in terms of, are they going to know that I'm really just making this shit up as I go along? But the more success you actually generate, I think you start to push that fear down, and you're right, you start to go, hang on, maybe I can do this. And people are asking me questions now, and I do know that this, you know, leads to this, and it'll, this works. And you start to develop the processes and the skills and the knowledge, and it does come with time, but yeah, you've got to fight that fear down at the start. And I don't think it ever goes away to an extent. You have to be brave enough to push through it. I have continuously worked out of my comfort zone. Still am at times.
I think most high performers do. And by high performers, I'm not, folks, I'm not talking about elite athletes and astronauts and neuro bloody surgeons. I'm just talking about people who get the most out of themselves. Like my mum's a high performer. She's a fucking straight up, you know, savage. So, you know, she is, she's a savage. I don't know how she's as strong and feisty and functional as she is. Like, you know, she's nearly died three times and still kicks me in the ass, you know? So she's a high performer, and it's just really about that. And I think, you know, creating any, whatever it is, a business, a brand, a new thing, a, you know, getting a degree, losing 40 kilos, overcoming addiction, all difficult things.
Yeah.
But a big part of it is really not so much about the thing, the external thing or outcome or process, but rather how do I manage me? How do I manage me first? How do I manage my self-doubt, my my imposter syndrome, my laziness, my lack of discipline, my ability to procrastinate and delay and delude and avoid and all of those human things.
That's the answer right there. If you can actually control those things, the rest just follows. It's totally the story we tell ourselves.
There we go, team. We're going to wind up temporarily here. This is the halfway point of the conversation. So we'll call this, as I said at the start, part one. We'll be back tomorrow with the second bit.